Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Today's guest, someone from the other side of the aisle. Someone with whom I disagree, but I really like him. He's a good dude. I enjoy having conversations with him, and I want to understand the perspective. And I think you'll find this conversation beneficial, even if you disagree with a large portion of it. That's okay. We're just listening to each other. That's the point of this, right? Senator Morgan McGarvey joining me on the Disruption Zone. And this one we started a little different, so you're just going to hear us pick up the conversation where we were talking about COVID-19. I'm worried about, like, I saw a headline this morning that, another big major retailer went bankrupt. There's a couple of retailers whose employees are suing them because they got sick, which is something you and I talked about early on in this. Is like, we got to find a way to protect, you know, it's mayhem out there. And I worry about continued ongoing fallout economically from this that we haven't even started to broach yet. You know, I mean, there's going to be a massive, I think, commercial real estate bubble pop because of the small businesses that are having to shut down that were leasing space. You know, that's going to be a scary thing. So,
well, it's also, you talk about the small businesses which are shutting, which is of course a concern. I mean, there's public safety, which is a concern, but then, you know, I look at some of the bigger companies too, and the employees and the business owners are finding out they can work from home.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe, wait a second, maybe we don't need to pay this huge amount of rent to have however many floors of big office building X downtown, when we could have a smaller workspace and allow, you know, more employee flexibility. So I agree with you. We are all living history.
Yeah. But it's also, you know, this is what I think is you got to find the bright spots. You know, like the beauty of capitalism is the adjustability and flexibility and adaptability of it. You know, like you said, I know that for me, what I do now, I work from home and set my schedule as I see fit. So I'm fortunate that this didn't affect me. There are some jobs that will never be able to change like that. But I have a lot of friends in business that are saying the same thing. Man, I realized I could save a lot of money by just trusting my employees to do their job, you know. And if you have the right people, that works.
That's right. And to some extent, time and productivity, right? I mean, if you live on one side of Louisville, you work on the other.
Right.
Total time. You know, by the time you walk out to your car, drive wherever you're going, get parked, get into the office, get set up, do the same thing when you go home. Right.
Right.
I mean, I don't think it's uncommon for people to lose an hour of their day just going to and from work.
Oh, easily. Isn't that part of the issue, though, with like the ongoing? Here comes the libertarian in me out. Warning. Isn't that part of the issue of the ongoing, like, extra money from the federal government and unemployment? Like, I think you look at it now and it's like there's a lot of employers that, especially small businesses, are like, I can't get my employees to come back to work because. I know Governor Beshear said a couple of weeks ago, he's like, if you think people aren't looking for a job over $600 a week, I'm like, oh, yes, that is absolutely a disincentive to work. Because if you make, you know, what, you know, if you make, like, say, between 15 and 20 bucks an hour, how much more does it cost you in time and other things to do that job when you could sit at home? Like, you know what I mean? Because that what you just pointed out is that period of time that you're in the car, you know, listening to jerks like me on the radio, that kind of thing. And then you go home, you know, and it's another hour or half hour, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, and so you brought out the libertarian. I'll bring out the Democrat in me now.
Didn't I tell you banned the Democrat from this conversation? I'm sorry.
No. I mean, first of all, I think people want to work, right? I just fundamentally believe that people want to work. People want to feel productive. They want to feel like they are doing something other than just sitting home. So I've never really bought into that narrative that people would rather sit at home. I think people want to work. I think the problem you get into in unemployment, I'll say this is twofold. The first is why are people making more in unemployment than they do at their jobs? I think that's more an indictment of how much we pay people to work than it is unemployment. And then the second thing, I'll talk about the unemployment a little bit just from a government response. You know, we got hit by the coronavirus. I think people made decisions. I think they made them with the best information they had at the time. And it's easy now for us to Monday morning quarterback everything that happened when the virus first really had its outbreak here. But, you know, this reminds me, and I've told a few people this, I'm dating myself here, but I was in college when September 11th happened. Mm-hmm. And so 9/11 happens, and I'm in college at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri, right? The smack dab middle of the state, quintessential college town. There is nothing there except the university.
Right.
Well, on September 11th, they closed the Columbia Mall for security reasons. I always remember that because picture Columbia, Missouri.
Like, well, who's going to attack the Columbia Mall?
Right. Picture the Columbia, Missouri Mall in any type of small town mall you've ever been in. This one won't disappoint your expectations. Yeah. But I think the anchor tenant was NC Sports. I mean, not even like a big national chain.
Dude, I've been to the Columbia Mall. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's right there off.
Don't ask me why.
I mean, yeah. So it's, they closed it for security reasons, and people don't make fun of them that because the whole nation was paralyzed at that point with the information we had. We didn't know if, when, where there could be another attack where people gathered. We were trying to keep everybody safe. And so maybe there were some mistakes made early on in how things were rolled out. We're all in this, and this is where I do buy in. We're all in this together. We're going to make some mistakes. What we should be doing is sitting down, talking about what problems are we facing? What are the best solutions for those problems with the best information we have now? And if we make some mistakes along the way, let's have a conversation and show each other a little grace. I mean, we've already said on this, podcast, we're living history, right? And we're trying to do it the best way we can. So that's kind of where I fall on the unemployment side of it.
Well, I think about what you said about sitting down, having a conversation with the information we have now. I think that's key because I don't think that's happening enough. You know, we could go into a whole long line about like I actually agree with your comment that people want to feel productive. But you also have to balance that with, you know, labor is worth what the skill brought to it is worth to the person who is hiring that labor. And that's where we get into this sort of area where you can't tell a private business owner what value is in the labor that's being done for their store or their restaurant unless you are that owner and understand what that entire transaction looks like. But to your point, we can't get to a place where there's that common ground if we can't have conversations like this. And I agree with you that at this point, we need to sit down and like, okay, what's the best way going forward? Because this thing's going to be around for a while. You know, how do we deal with that? And I'm not seeing a lot. I see, this is one reason why I respect you so much, because even though I know we disagree fundamentally on some issues, you're never afraid to come in and have that conversation. I want more of that, and I respect that about you. And I see it in some places. I just feel like that most of our country is now, for whatever reason, I'm sad that we've so politicized this virus. Like, to me, that's just absurd, because I'm like, this is a virus. This isn't a place where we have to try to score political points on one another. It drives me nuts.
No, it drives me crazy. And this is what I say all the time. We've got to get back to a point where we can agree on what the problem is and then constructively disagree on the solutions.
Yeah.
I'm not a Pollyanna. I don't expect people to agree on the way to solve problems. But right now, we can't agree on the problem. I mean, we had lawmakers, including a president, who were saying that a global pandemic was a hoax when it first started.
Right.
We couldn't even agree that we were in a pandemic. And then how do you solve that?
Right.
You can't even agree it's a problem. I think, you know, on the wages and in the unemployment, you know, things you were talking about a productivity side, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the other thing, and we didn't mention this, and this is why these problems, we've got to agree on the problem, and then we've got to talk about the solutions, because the solutions, as much as people want them all to be easy, they're not always easy, right? So if you're working, let's call it 45, even 50 hours a week, and you're at a low-wage job, what is one thing you have to have if you're going to be there? It's some type of childcare. Mm-hmm. whether that's having a child in school, whether it's having a child in daycare, whether it's having a child in school plus after school programs, whatever it is, right? So all of a sudden you've got a low wage job. There's no childcare available. You know, this is a situation we faced before the pandemic,
right.
But the pandemic just exacerbated
right.
all of the problems and all of the cracks that were already there.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are having this problem now where it's like, yeah, if what do I do with my kid if we don't open schools back up? Which is one reason why I think when you do look at the research, this goes back to sitting down and looking at the information that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's one reason why I think it's probably not a problem to reopen the schools. You know, kids are not so much having an issue with this. And there are ways that we could probably mitigate that, you know, causing more of a spread. Because at some point we have to go back and live our lives, you know. I mean, I hate that, but I mean, I hate to say it that way, but it is what it is. I mean, at some point we're human beings and we faced viruses and lived with viruses throughout the history of humankind. And at some point we have to live our lives and recognize that, you know, this is killing people, and I hate that, but it's also killing a very small percentage of the people who get it. And I think this is where I come in and say the economy kind of outweighs, and people are going to say, oh, no, I don't want to kill grandma. I'm saying we should look at this from a holistic point of view and say, all right, let's keep the vulnerable home. Let's keep that population separated. And then let's let the healthy and the young go back and live their lives, because, you know, the only way really through this is through it, unfortunately. I think we have to develop a sort of sense of herd immunity. And I don't want everybody to go out and get sick. I think masks in public are a good idea. I think 6 foot of distancing. I mean, one thing I'm hopeful of this fall, Senator McGarvey, is that we don't have as bad of a flu season, because people will actually stay home from work if they get sick, and they won't be breathing on each other. Because, I mean, in that maybe this changes how we approach that, you know. That would be good.
And communicable diseases are down. I was talking to a physician last week who was telling me, you know, all these communities, of course they are, right? Mm-hmm. We're washing our hands, we're wearing masks, we're social distancing.
Yeah.
They should be. You know, I will say that when you talk about a different type of solution to this, a couple of things. First of all, I've noticed with COVID-19, it's almost the ultimate not in my backyard type political scenario, right? Mm-hmm. Where someone says they want affordable housing, but not in my backyard. They want this, but not in, they want better transportation, but don't build it in my backyard, right? Mm-hmm. With COVID-19, it is, we want people to go about and live their lives, but we don't want to get sick, and we don't want our families to get sick.
Right.
And that's where this is a communicable disease that the spread is only stopped by the entire community. And we're also, this goes back to, they call it a novel virus for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're all looking at this, and there are reports now that, yeah, you know what, we're learning better ways to control it. We're learning that it could be vascular, not just respiratory. The ventilators might or might not work like we first thought. You remember when everybody was like building ventilator upon ventilator, and maybe that's not the best thing.
Yeah, there's some evidence that actually was harmful to the people that were put on them.
But we're watching the scientific method and science play out in real time. And it's very frustrating for the, you know, the internet microwave society that says we want something right now.
Right.
We want a firm answer, and we want it to always stick. And so, you know, we're seeing now evidence with COVID that you could get sick, and it could be like, you know, I have a relative who had heart problems much later in life that were absolutely a result of scarlet fever. You know, a virus way back in the day. So what are the long-term repercussions of having what right now might not seem like a very bad disease? I mean, everyone wants to compare this to the flu. I'll tell you, I've had the flu. You've had the flu. One, there's a vaccine. Two, I'm not telling you that years later, I feel the effects of the flu I had 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I felt pretty bad for a week, but then I was gone. So yeah, this is, it's tough. It's frustrating for everybody. But you know, that's where I think we've got to, I'd like to see better leadership on the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just be honest. I'd like to see better leadership from the president. This is where the president needs to be a leader and needs to bring the American people together to solve a problem.
Right.
He is not doing that. And you know, that frustrates me.
I can't say I disagree at this point. You know, I think,
you know what?
I think he made some good moves at the beginning. I think now I'm speaking from just where the way I analyze politics right now, I feel like he doesn't quite know where to put his foot. but I also, I think, you know, that's ultimately his responsibility as the president, but I also lay some responsibility for that at the media's feet, because there is so much conflicting information and the media is not helping with that. I mean, hydroxychloroquine is one of perfect example. I've spoken with several doctors who are using it and it is effective. Mm-hmm. And yet we continually see these competing stories in the competing left-wing, right-wing media outlets that are like, well, our scientists say it doesn't work and it's ridiculous. And then the other side says, well, our scientists say it does and it's ridiculous. And then you've got social media banning anyone who says, well, I think it might work. I got put in Facebook jail. This is actually kind of a funny story. Yesterday, I woke up, I put up a post Saturday, and it was very popular, like hundreds of likes. And what it was Dr. Fauci, because he said last week, you know, we should wear goggles to stop the spread of this virus. And I thought that was funny. And so, you know me, I'm a sarcastic SOB. And so I found this like fake ABC News story, and it's Dr. Fauci with a plastic fan melded to his head. And it says, Dr. Fauci says, implant a fan on your head to blow the virus away. So I posted that on Facebook and I was like, hey, look, Dr. Fauci finally found the most effective way to keep from getting coronavirus. I wake up Sunday morning after this thing got hundreds of hits and a bunch of shares, and it was Facebook saying, we have deleted your post because you're spreading false information about COVID-19. And I was like, what the? So, and then it says, do you agree or disagree? And I was like, I freaking disagree. So I clicked the disagree button because I was like, I'm going to write on there and I'm going to tell them how it was satire and they need to get a freaking sense of humor and they need to understand it was just satire. There's no opportunity for me to actually write that it was satire, even though it was very clearly satire. I mean, he's got a plastic fan on his head. Come on. And I had the emojis with the laughing and the tears and stuff, you know, so it was clear I wasn't being serious. They just simply gave me an option to agree or disagree. There was nowhere to explain it. And then like 20 seconds later, they come back and they go, we saw that you disagree. We disagree. It's deleted. And they're like, if you do this again, we're going to ban you from Facebook. And I'm just like, this is not helpful, right? I mean, this is not helpful to dialogue. So to your point, I think there's a lot of confusion. And I think this is where it goes back to what we said about politicizing. Once it becomes politicized, it's hard to drill down. What is the science on this virus? And you know what's totally missing, Senator McGarvey? There is, I don't hear anybody, Republican or Democrat, and I know you're an open-minded guy, so maybe you'll start doing this because I think you'll probably agree with what I'm about to say, but I don't hear anybody talking about how do we as a nation get healthy so we're less susceptible to stuff like this, right? Like, our immune system sucks because we are so fat and we are so out of shape and we are so eating bad. And I don't hear anybody saying, you know what? Take 4,000 IUs of zinc, or excuse me, 4,000 IUs of vitamin D and some zinc and get outside and freaking move your butt and stop eating bad processed food. That, I think, would save a lot of people's lives.
Well, no one is having that conversation. I would love to have the conversation about the unhealthy nature of our country and particularly our state. I mean, yeah. Kentucky really is an unhealthy state. I think as part of that, though, we have to have an honest conversation about poverty in this country. Hmm. The number of people who are food insecure, the number of people who are buying, as you just called it, the processed crap. Because you know what? It's way cheaper to feed a family of four on cheaper, unhealthy food than it is. I mean, you're not going to Whole Foods and buying organic this and that and having the right stuff.
How are you going to do that, though? Because I grew up poor. I mean, I was a missionary kid. So I ate a lot of this really bad food. It was, like you said, you can go to White Castle. You can go to McDonald's and get everybody a cheeseburger for, you know, $5 and not starve. And I think that's a blessing that we live in a country where you can avoid starvation by going to the, you know, if you've got $5 and a family of five, you can avoid starvation. You're not going to starve if you get a cheeseburger a day. You know, if that's all you get, you're not going to starve.
Right.
And I agree with you, and I would like to see more healthy options. I just don't know how, when we talk about poverty, it's like, how are you going to deliver fresh, organic food, grass-fed? I would prefer, because see, I think this is a bigger systemic problem, okay? Mm-hmm. Boy, we're getting into the weeds here, and we haven't even started talking about what we're going to talk about. But this is fun. I have these, and this is where maybe my conservative friends are going to think I'm kind of crazy, but I think the way we look at farming in America needs to change entirely. Now, I'm a free market guy, and I want people to do, I want free markets. So don't mistake what I'm about to say as me saying I want to force people to do it a certain way. But
I can't wait to hear your free market analogy when it comes to farming when you look at the subsidies that we give farmers.
I'm all over getting rid of that.
I'm interested in it. I've never supported it.
A lot of why farmers need subsidies is because the government is either paying them not to grow something or paying them to grow something we don't need and putting it in a bin or destroying it. And if you got the government out of the business of farming and you kind of turned it back over to farmers, you know, I had Congressman Massey on about this, and we talked about cattle, for instance, because he farms cattle, and he was talking about some of the things that go on with the subsidies and all of this. And I don't want to misquote him, so people can go back and listen to that swamp episode that we did about the Washington swamp. And he was talking about a fundraiser that he had originally, the first group that was going to do a fundraiser for him when he first got to Congress. And it was like, I think it was the Cattlemen's Association, the national version. And they were all excited because he raised his cattle and they were going to do a fart thing for him. And then he voted the wrong way on a bill that they wanted that didn't help farmers. And he thought he did the right thing because it didn't help like cattle farmers. And the association basically disavowed him, canceled his fundraiser, and told him to beat the, you know, sand. And he was like, what did I do? And he's like, because he just voted his conscience, and he voted to help farmers. He didn't vote to help. Well, it turns out he didn't vote to help this huge thing that was going to help the actual processors. And there's these organizations that masquerade as supporting farmers or supporting various different groups. They masquerade as that, but really what they're doing is they're helping these big businesses that are sort of the middleman in between, and it's part of what keeps prices where they are. It's the whole thing within agriculture is a complete price-fixing deal. I mean, it's more socialist than free market in a major way, in my opinion. So anyway, back to the point. You're getting me off on these rabbit trails, and I know you're having fun with it. But I would like to see farming change where, you know, it's more like, have you heard of Polyface Farms in Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
This dude is amazing, right? So what he does is it's total grass fed, it's total organic, and I heard him on Joe Rogan's podcast, and he was like, dude, we could totally farm enough of this stuff. It's going to be more expensive ultimately a little bit, but he pointed to this statistic that in the, I think, 1970s, we paid 18% of our income for food, okay? Today, and we paid 9% of our income for healthcare in the 1970s. Okay, so 40, 50 years ago. Today, we pay 18% of our income for healthcare and 9% of our income for food. If you reversed that, you could afford double the prices of food, right? Everybody was eating what Whole Foods food costs, but there's none of this healthcare cost because we're all healthier. And so we're spending less on our healthcare. We're spending a little more on our food. So in other words, there's all these hidden things in the structure of the business of food and agriculture that are driving the prices to where they probably shouldn't be. So when we talk about poverty, you and I probably have a different idea for how we get fresher, less expensive, or healthier food to poor people. But I think we probably both agree that that would be a good thing. Does that make any sense at all for that long diatribe?
No, it doesn't. Obviously, I want to listen to a Joe Rogan podcast. That sounds like an interesting thing.
I'll send you a link to that episode, and I'll send you a link to the episode with Massey, too. I think you would enjoy both of those.
And you and I, because we won't go down the rabbit hole of healthcare on this podcast now.
Right.
That's a different.
Take 5 hours.
Let's just set aside that conversation. But you know, what you just said is what I alluded to earlier. We agree on a problem.
Right.
Now let's have an honest conversation about what we view as the solutions and why we view them as solutions. Because, you know, when you start doing that, first of all, I mean, I come into it with a predisposed set of values.
Sure.
If you want to call it bias, call it a bias. Informed by my life experiences and my thought process, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you go into it with those biases, with still an openness and a willingness to listen, right, to someone else who's coming in there with their own biases and values, if you're both coming at it from a good place, right? From a place of honest concern, you know, genuine wanting to make things better, then that's when you get an exchange of ideas. I'm not saying you're going to convince me of your point of view or I'm going to convince you of my point of view, but what you start to do is go, okay, well, I still ultimately don't agree with his entire solution, but that piece makes sense.
Well, it's about
like
it's
that
about
piece right there. They said,
yeah, it's about understanding the perspective too.
That's right. And then you start to come up, but that's how you craft policy that ultimately does get passed and moves the ball forward.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Is by not by just ruling by one side saying, here's how it's going to be. And then it happens. And then of course there becomes another wave election. And then this side says, well, no, this is how it's going to be. When there's not that input, it doesn't usually work that well.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I wanted to try to do in this podcast was have a, I guess, a liberal and a conservative find some common ground. And you and I have talked about no-knock raids before. And so I want to kind of talk about police reform a little bit. Before I do want to get your comments on this Nulu situation.
Sure.
That is happening. And, of course, the Black Lives Matter group in Louisville apparently sent a group of businesses in Nulu a series of demands. And there are a couple of those businesses that are bucking against that, you know, and the demands are things like you have to hire a certain number of people from our community. You have to give a certain percentage of your money to these approved organizations. It really feels like extortion to me because there's an implied, I mean, when you have a group of citizens giving a demand to a private business versus giving a demand to, say, Senator Morgan McGarvey, you know, an elected official. There's kind of an implied consequence if those demands are not met. And there's one particular business owner who is saying that while they were having a conversation at his door, somebody was breaking part of his property and doing some stuff. So the implied threat was definitely there. I don't feel like that advances the conversation. Like, I understand if you go and you talk to, you know, Senator Morgan McGarvey, hey, we have these issues because I think a lot of it centers around this idea of gentrification, right? Nulu is a pretty cool section of town. But there are people who say, hey, look, we've been pushed out because this other stuff has come in. And I want to understand that perspective, but I also don't feel like what's being done here is advancing the conversation and helping to bring that understanding of the perspective, because it looks like extortion as opposed to we have these issues we want people to understand and we want our elected officials and government agencies to help us deal with that. And so I think this is creating more division and strife. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, we've seen successful boycotts and private action against private businesses in all sectors for all kinds of reasons for a long time. I mean, I remember, let's go back and let's do something that was more on the right side of the political spectrum when people said, we're not listening to your radio station if you play the Dixie Chicks.
Right.
And so guess what? Radio stations stopped playing the Dixie Chicks, right? Or this is more politically agnostic, at least on its face. I think there was a time a long time ago when if Walmart carried albums that had explicit lyrics, people wouldn't shop there. So Walmart pulled all the albums. This is back when people listening, kids listening, this is back when you used to go to a store to buy your music. If it had explicit lyrics, you couldn't get it at Walmart, right? Because people made these demands and said, if you don't do this, we won't shop there. We won't do this.
Yeah.
And so they are effective. And in some ways they are more effective than coming to someone like me about something. I think what's interesting about this is, when I read the stories, it wasn't clear the group it was coming from. And it wasn't clear to whom those demands could be addressed or sought out. I saw the president of the Nulu Business Association say, you know what? There's a lot of stuff here we agree with.
Right.
And I agree with that. I mean, we have some shameful practices in Louisville that we need to make better. It is pitiful that our Black population is 23% of our city and 2.4% of our businesses are Black owned. And it's not random.
Right.
Right. It's not because of an inferiority or a superiority this is after hundreds of years of systematic oppression, right, that has led to this result. And we have to have some changes.
Let me just kind of interject here, because as an American, I want to fix that.
Right.
I'm just being honest. I don't want to fix that. But you cannot fix that by saying, from government or anybody saying, all right, 23% of businesses are now going to be black owned to better reflect that. No. That's not how you fix that problem. How you fix that problem is you get, first of all, you got to get government out of the way so that people can actually go into business without being overregulated to death. That's one way. And you have to have, you can't say every time a business comes in, well, that's gentrification. So you got to get out or you got to do it different. You know what I mean? I mean, business works. Business is apolitical. Business is, I need to sell these products at a profit so that I can make money and make a living. That is what business is. And so I don't see the answer to this being intimidating businesses saying, look, we're going to give you a bunch of fake bad reviews if you don't do what we say. Like, that to me is not going to make those businesses prosper, and it's not going to make everybody better off in the end.
No. So a couple of thoughts.
Yeah.
One, I mean, we've got to have this conversation, and we can't have it in a way that we can just easily sweep it under the rug.
Sure.
I also think that any objective person is going to tell you that the demands we're given, not all of those demands are even possible. I just say this. You know, one of the demands I think is that you donate 1.5% of your net sales, right?
Right. This which is could not be all profits. Which could be all of your profits in a small business.
If you're a restaurant, a small business restaurant, that really might be 100% of your profit. So if you do everything, every one of your demands, then 2 months later, they show up and say, we're closing our doors. Say, why? I said, well, we're giving away all of our profits.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but still, good conversations to be having about gentrification. I think this is something where we really have to look at it from a policy perspective.
Mm-hmm.
For too long, we have examples of pushing groups of people around using what seemingly look like fair rules, but mm-hmm. that stack the deck. There we go. Stack the deck.
It's the only subsidy you get from me today, Morgan McGarvey.
That's right. Yeah.
I help you with that sentence.
Listen, with COVID brain, that's the only mistake I made today in a however long conversation. We're in great shape.
Yeah.
It's Monday morning, Leland.
No doubt.
But, you know, one of the problems, and I'm looking at this right now with some Republican lawmakers at a legislative from a legislative standpoint, mm-hmm. is how do we have renewal without gentrification?
Okay, let me pause you there, because help me understand this. Mm-hmm. And I'm genuinely seeking to understand the concept here.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where I get confused, and I think a lot of people get confused, okay? When we say gentrification, I'm like, okay, the neighborhood's nice. Doesn't everybody want the neighborhood to be nice? And mm-hmm. then on the other side, I hear, well, but that's pushing us out. I don't understand that perspective. Help me understand that perspective. So if there is a difference between revitalization and gentrification, for the sake of understanding, help me understand that.
Okay, very easy. Picture a couple of city blocks.
Yep.
Right? Where you've got houses and some of them are run down, but there's some people who've lived in the neighborhood for a long time. They like the fabric of their neighborhood. They like the community. There have been some problems. And, you know, some houses have been boarded up. Some people have left. There's some vacant and abandoned property. You incentivize people to come in and fix it up. Well, you start fixing it up and you start making these properties a little bit nicer. We are bound right now by sections 170 through 172 of the Kentucky Constitution in how we value property.
Okay.
So if you start bringing in a new business because you've given them some government incentive, and you start bringing in some newer, nicer housing, and sort of, what happens? It makes your property grow up.
Mm-hmm.
So grandma's sitting there in the house she's lived in for 50 years, and all of a sudden some good things are happening again in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and her property's going up, her property value's going up. She can't afford to pay the property taxes on the place where she's lived for a long time. There's no subsidy for her. There's a subsidy for the business.
But she has an asset she's never had before.
She has an asset, but she can't pay for it.
Right, but again, there's an asset there now that she has that she's never had before. She has wealth. For the first time, she has wealth.
I said grandma, right? So mm-hmm. grandma's, let's say grandma, like so many grandparents in Kentucky, so many older, she's on a fixed income.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so you put an extra $1,000 on somebody's tax, so they sell their home.
That's because you guys charge us too much in property taxes, McGarvey. I mean, stop charging so much in property taxes so we can freaking breathe.
But again, that is part of that's constitutional.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Right? Part of that is a fixed value. And so all of a sudden you are displacing someone, because I mean, we know this, 50% of Americans don't have access to $500 or more in cash.
Right.
And so when you do this, what we want to do is, what we're looking at a legislative solution is, okay, how can we change this? And maybe it's through a constitutional amendment. Maybe we can do it through statutes in a way we can allow certain things that are constitutional. But how do you come in and take away some of the blight that's in some of these areas while still allowing people who were there before to keep a similar property tax rate?
Okay, but hold on. This is what I want to understand. I just want to understand this. The way that we're forced to do property taxes now is what? When you say that we're bound by two statutes in the state constitution, how we value property, mm-hmm. what is it about that? How we are bound to what? In terms of determining what grandma's property value is.
What is the actual value today, given everything around it?
Okay. So what do you want to do to fix that? So grandma can stay in her house, but we can still update the neighborhood so that grandma's house rises in value. Grandma has asset
in value.
So that she passes mm-hmm. that on to her children. Because part of the problem with generational poverty, and I come from a family that was generationally poor prior to my dad getting a college education. As far as I know, I think he was the first of his siblings to get a college degree. He grew up, interestingly enough, in the projects in Louisville part of his time. And then he ran away from home because he had a, you know, home situation, and ended up at 12 years old living with one of his uncles, a tobacco farmer in Shelby County. And that's how the whole Conway family began. Long story. Mm-hmm. The point is, it was generational poverty. And so when my grandfather on my dad's side died, nobody got any inheritance. I got his broken guitar. There was nothing to leave. There was an old Airstream trailer in a trailer park. There was nothing to leave. Part of the problem that we have here with generational poverty is that we have families that beget generations of families that beget generations of families, and there's nothing passing down. Whereas on the other side, you see people gaining wealth and passing that wealth on to their children generationally. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what creates this sort of schism that exists, that people complain about, I think, a lot. And I'm like, okay, I see that. I see you, generational mm-hmm. poverty. Let's figure out how to fix that. Right. So how are you addressing this, that we can still have a cool place like Nulu, but grandma can stay in her house in Nulu and not be run out by the new property value taxes?
One, since we're talking about grandparents, let's talk about literally a grandfather clause, where you live in the neighborhood and your property taxes are going to stay sort of consistent with what you've been paying. And there's going to be some increase as property values hopefully increase instead of decrease, but not the type of drastic increase that's going to force people out of their neighborhood.
Right.
Here's another thing. We're talking about generational poverty and the poverty that exists in Louisville and in Kentucky, and that we've got to do a better job addressing. A lot of people don't own. They're renting anyway. Mm-hmm. So somebody comes in, their rent skyrockets way up, even though their building hasn't been fixed. The landlord is not even probably up to code on their building, which is a whole different problem, a predatory practice we have to address. And all of a sudden, that same sort of crappy landlord is telling grandma, your rent is $250 a month more.
So what would you propose then? Would you propose, when you say grandfather clause, what are we saying? We're saying, mm-hmm. if grandma owns her house, she's lived in this area for 40 years, mm-hmm. All of a sudden it starts to quote unquote gentrify or update or mm-hmm. whatever. It becomes a popular area of town. There's now a farmer's market providing all that fresh food in an area that was formerly a food desert that you talk about. Mm-hmm. There's now business opportunities for people to get jobs in that community and be able to work and live in their own community. But daggone it, the taxes are going up. Yeah. A grandfather clause would say that if you've owned this house for X amount of years, you're going to pay a rate that's slightly higher but somewhat consistent with what you had. Now, what happens if grandma sells her house and says, ha, I got an asset. I'm moving to a gated neighborhood. Now what happens to the person that buys it? And because then it becomes attractive to say, hey, there's a house over here and it has lower property taxes than the one I'm in Odom County, you know what I mean? And so I'll take that, because then now it's turning into a nice neighborhood. Crime is down. Cool places to go. How do you stop that? Does it just stay with that family or what?
Well, first of all, I'm going to tell you that about 2 weeks ago, we had an hour and a half meeting with stakeholders on this. Last week, we had about a 2.5 hour meeting. We have another meeting next week where we are looking just at this problem. And let me tell you, still don't have all the answers.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, if we're going to be serious about this, it's not going to be a soundbite solution.
No, sure. Yeah.
Right. You know,
and I'm not trying to goad you into a soundbite here. That's why we're doing a podcast. No, we don't have to worry about we don't have to worry about commercials, yeah, man.
And so I just want to tell you right now, I don't have every single answer.
Okay. That's
fair. But what we're talking about very specifically is the ownership of property by people on fixed income or, you know, it could just be elderly. I mean, there's a lot of people who aren't even necessarily, well, I mean, I won't say that, but this is a complex problem, right? And yeah, what happens when you sell? What happens when, how do you keep an area from truly just gentrifying and losing the fabric of that community, things that people want there and ultimately
displacing the neighborhood? Yeah, because I mean, it seems like it seems like if you don't do this, every solution comes with its own set of problems so far that I'm hearing. Because again, we agree on the problem. Every solution that I've heard so far comes with its own set of problems. Like you could, again, I'll go back to grandma now has an asset that's worth something. Mm-hmm. Grandma could get a home equity loan now that she could never have gotten before, fix up the home. Suddenly it's nice. But again, that's going to raise the, but that's the way the system works. Maybe she can, maybe she doesn't want to borrow that much. That's fine. I'm not saying, I'm just saying there are options once you have assets. I mean, that's part of the problem with generational poverty is that you don't have assets. So there's no, there's no mobility in money because money is mobility, right? I mean, money says if I have money, you know, it's mobility. It's the ability to go places, do things, live somewhere, you know. Now, because so I would think that our goal should always to be to get all of those grandmas to have assets. They now have some certain amount of freedom. Yeah, the taxes could go up. Maybe we can come to some kind of agreement on a policy that doesn't run them out of their house so they then have to sell. Because now I think I see what you're getting at in terms of the concept. When they say run out of the neighborhood, I'm thinking about it from, well, everybody's property value went up, right? But they can't afford the taxes, so they have to sell and move somewhere else. They didn't want to sell. They didn't want to move somewhere else. Okay, I understand that. So
it's like the joke, you know, if you went on a game show and you had no money and you won a Porsche, you couldn't afford to get the free
Porsche.
Pay
the taxes. You couldn't pay the taxes on it. Yeah, no, I totally get that. That's why now when you see all these home shows on HGTV, they're giving cash with it. And you're like, oh, wow, a nice house and $500,000. I'm like, fool, that $500,000 is to pay the taxes on the house. You're not getting any cash.
That's right.
And then you got to turn around and sell it because you won't be able to pay next year's taxes. I get it. This is interesting stuff. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, it's interesting and it's complex. And it's also, I mean, look, take Nulu, for example. Yeah, Nulu is a great, cool area of town. Lots of cool restaurants, lots of cool shops. I mean, we've been there and enjoy it. So you want areas of town like that. But also there were big incentives that gave to a lot of those buildings and businesses locating there. Mm-hmm. Right. We're not giving those incentives to help the people who were living in areas like that. We just displace them. I mean, this is one of the reasons, and I'm passionate about fair and affordable housing. I co-founded an affordable housing caucus, which is bipartisan in the state legislature, because I mean, we've got to do a better job of looking at this, looking at generational poverty, but looking at different aspects of it. Housing is absolutely one of those. When you talk about racial justice, environmental justice, generational poverty, you've got to be looking at housing in all three of those buckets. How can we do a better job of having affordable housing and having, you know, a consistency of neighborhood and things for everyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's not a great answer.
Right. There's no question that you know, you take pride in things that are nice. And if people's homes are nice and you keep them up, it tends to discourage a whole lot of bad behavior. So, I mean, I want to see more of that. I want to see those neighborhoods get nice. I want to see those neighborhoods offer those business opportunities. I want to see those things come in. I feel like we're at somewhat of an impasse here in the sense that, you know, everything we've discussed that we agree on, hey, I'd like to see people in poor areas have more access to healthy food. But if I bring a really cool farmer's market that everybody wants to come shop at, then I'm going to be accused of gentrification and running people out of the neighborhood, right? I mean, you see where it, like, that's my perspective. It's like, wait, I want to help solve these problems, but I just want, you know, I don't, this, the solution creates another sack of problems that come with it, you know, unless, unless we're doing it in a more free market based way. That's what I want to see ultimately the answers be. But I don't know. I just wanted to understand that. You've helped me at least understand the concept that there's a difference between, say, enlivening a neighborhood versus the idea behind gentrification. And that's what I was seeking to understand. What is that concept? You know. All right, let me interrupt this regularly scheduled podcast to tell you that it went a little long. So long so that I had to actually break it into two parts. So keep listening to part B, which I'll post at the same time. So you don't have to wait for the next part of this conversation. You can just roll right into the next one right there on the downloads or right there on our website, thedisruptionzone.com. So just keep going. Just listen to part two. Thanks. The Disruption Zone.